Welcome to yet another episode of Shortcast Over Coffee. My guest today is Utkarsha Agwan. Utkarsha is a core team member of Climate Change AI, a global non-profit that catalyzes impactful work at the intersection of climate change and machine learning. Climate Change AI has led the creation of a global movement in climate change and machine learning, encompassing researchers, engineers, entrepreneurs, investors, policymakers, companies, and NGOs. She has a PhD degree in electrical engineering and computer science from UC Berkeley, where her research focused on distributed energy sources, specifically batteries, electric vehicles, and flexible loads, and how they can participate in the larger power grid. In this episode, I talk to Utkarsha about AI ethics in climate tech, the top problems in climate change that are being tackled using machine learning, and also solving nuclear fusion. In the last part of this episode, both Utkarsha and I say nuclear fission instead of nuclear fusion. I really hope you guys excuse us for the slip of tongue. Please do like, share, and subscribe this podcast, Shortcast Over Coffee, on top podcast platforms like Spotify, Apple, etc. This is also the first in-person episode of this podcast. Now, without further ado, let's dive right in. Hi, Utkarsha. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Bala. Thank you.
Yeah, so we are here to talk about the work of climate change AI.
Yeah.
So, let's get started with what you guys do and how did you get started with climate change AI?
So, maybe it makes more sense to talk about how I came across climate change AI first, which is that I read this. So, I started grad school in 2018. I started my PhD then. And I really wanted to work on climate change. And everyone in ECS, which is the department that I was in, works on machine learning. So I was trying to find a way to, you know, work using the hot technique or the hot method, but on a problem that I cared about. And I came across this paper, which was published in 2019. It's called Tackling Climate Change with Machine Learning. I don't know, have you seen it? No, it was, it's a pretty cool paper. It's very long. And it's basically mapping out a number of application areas in climate change mitigation and climate change adaptation and so on. And it's mapping them to machine learning techniques. So it's saying, look, if you are an NLP person, you should probably think about applying your expertise to this area of climate tech. Or if you're a time series analysis person, then this is what you should be working on. If you know computer vision, these are the areas that need your help. So, I mean, the paper is incredibly detailed. It gives you a small overview of a variety of application areas. It talks about the problems. It talks about the methods that could potentially be used. And it's got this key table at the end, which is this mapping. And I thought that was incredibly cool because this is, look, someone already solved the problem for me. Someone told me, look, if you want to do this kind of math, this is what you need to be working on. So that paper was actually written by a number of experts, including three of the co-founders of Climate Change AI. So it was Priya Donti, David Rolnick, and Lynn Koch. And these guys wrote the paper it came out in 2019. And shortly following that, they founded Climate Change AI, which was intended to be and is a nonprofit to catalyze work at the intersection of climate change and machine learning. So the idea is you've got this huge mankind scale problem, and you've got one of the most powerful technologies that's actively under development right now. How do you get experts of these two areas to come together and work on problems that matter?
Do you remember any specific areas of climate change that the paper was looking to address? Or
I mean, it went through all of the major emission sectors. So when you think about greenhouse gas emissions, you're typically looking at energy-related emissions. So that's buildings, electricity, chemicals, and industry. So they're typically, you know, burning coal or burning fuel to generate either electricity or heat. And then there's the non-energy-related sector. So agriculture, for example, that's cows burping. So they went through each of those sectors and then smaller problem domain areas within those and then looked at them.
Great. So pertaining to just climate change and your personal interest in climate change and climate tech. Did you have a background or you just came across this paper without having any background or interest? Or did you have in the back of your mind that, hey, you know, this is an issue that the world needs to be concerned about and I need to dive deep into it? Like, were you always that person who this bothered you?
I was always that person. Mm. So ever since I was in school, I knew that I wanted to work on climate change in some way.
Mm.
At that time, the problem was narrower in my head. We used to call it global warming back then when we were in school. And the problem was, hey, you're burning coal. Stop burning coal, use solar. So that was sort of the simplistic message that I had in my mind. And so for me, I really wanted to work on solar. So that's why I went off to do electrical engineering in my undergrad. And my idea was, I'm going to make better solar cells. One of the problems is, you know, you've got efficiencies of what, 27%, 27% or so. What if you could double that? Solar would be the cheapest source, blah, blah, blah. So turns out that solar is actually sort of a solved problem. Technology-wise, at least we've got very good solutions. And the problems that are, you know, bigger hurdles right now are not making more efficient solar cells. There's a variety of other problems that are causing huge challenges. So then when I came to grad school, I had this research grant funding me, which was for research in smart buildings. And so power grid, smart buildings, that's sort of how my research evolved. And that's why I was looking for this paper.
Yeah, I just want to double down on the whole solar thing. You mentioned that solar was more or less solved, except for the efficiency part. So could you tell me more about, you know, what was solved in the recent years versus what was the gap earlier?
Yeah, I should be careful about using the word solved. It's not really solved. But there's enough technological know-how, enough scale of manufacturing that solar is right now the cheapest new source of generation. And it's been that way for a couple of years, at least when I started grad school, that was already the case. And California already had the problem of having too much solar on the grid, where they would get these ramp downs of net energy consumption in the middle of the day, right? When the sun would come out. And they would get these huge ramp ups in the evening when the sun would set and everyone would still be consuming electricity. So in that sense, solar has sort of been solved for a while, where we know how to make it cheaply. We know how to deploy it. It's sort of reliable enough that we can get a lot of traditional financiers to back huge projects. But there's a whole other piece of the puzzle that's not solved, which is, for example, if you're putting solar in the places where it's the sunniest, that's not necessarily the place where the power grid is equipped to handle that solar. So there's things on the power grid side that still remain a problem.
Yeah, very interesting. And I think in the US we also have this problem of not having the grid integrated, right? So there is the ERCOT grid in Texas, and then there is the so when this surge happens in generation of solar energy, what happens? Does it just go to waste, or is there a way to, you know, sort of send that power elsewhere, even though there will be transmission losses, etc.?
So just talking about the power grid a little bit. So the way the US power grid is set up is that you've got this whole Western interconnect, Eastern interconnect, and then there's Texas in the middle, which has an isolated grid. So the problem is that all of the Western states are going to get solar at the same time. Now, other states don't have this problem as much as California does. And there's transmission losses in sending electrical energy from one state to another. There's also just the problem of capacity, that you might not have a transmission line with enough capacity to send energy from California to somewhere else. But, sorry, can you remind me what the second thing you said was?
Yeah, I was asking when there is an excess generation of power, you know, what is being done? Does it go to waste?
It does go to waste. They call it curtailing. Basically, solar is the lowest marginal cost resource. So it's usually bidding into these electricity markets at $0 per megawatt hour. What that means is that they'll just stop, even though solar is the cheapest source of energy, you know, it's bidding in at $0 per megawatt hours, they still have to end up curtailing it, because they just don't have enough demand to serve it. And so around the time that Bitcoin and crypto was getting this huge gold rush, That was actually one of the things that a couple of crypto startups tried to position themselves as. They said, oh, look, we're going to be clean because we'll just consume all of the curtailed solar. But yeah, there is a lot of curtailed solar. It's at the grid level. It's also at the residential level. So yeah, that's what they do.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I was reading about some of the stuff that goes around this thing called carbon-aware computing, yeah. Wherein you have dirtier sources of power, you know, data centers running on dirtier sources of power, and then they usually don't run when the production is from dirtier sources, and they just, you know, offload it to some other center. So I think US has a large enough landmass which can sort of, I would say, balance out power generation, right? Like the Midwest generates a huge amount of wind energy. There is a lot of geothermal now coming up with multiple companies like Fervo Energy that comes to mind. And also solar in Arizona, New Mexico, and California. Do you think that integrating the grid is going to solve the problem, or is are we looking at something that's, too big?
Honestly, I think we have a better chance of commercializing nuclear fission than we have of integrating the power grid. Because at this point, it's not a technological problem. So if it were a technological problem, I do believe that we could have found a solution. We could have scaled it. It's a huge infrastructure problem, which requires a lot of regulators to care about the same thing at the same time.
Is it a policy problem?
It's a policy problem. Okay. It's a financing problem. It requires a lot of political will to do something that's going to take years to build out. And I know that the US has had infrastructure pushes in the past where it's revolutionized, for example, its roadways. But I don't think folks are really banking on integrating the power grid as a potential solution. And I'm definitely not the person to speak about US policy or US regulations, but I don't think people are touting that as a viable solution. I think there's going to be other alternatives.
Excellent. Yeah, we'll see how that goes. So we spoke about climate change, AI, and how you got interested in it. And we spoke briefly about the power generation, you know, the renewable power generation in the US. Now, coming back to climate change, AI, what are some of the fronts that you are tackling using machine learning? What are probably the top two or three areas that you're focusing on?
So we're actually not a research organization ourselves. One of the things that we do is fund research and highlight gaps where we think researchers can play a role. So the things that we are doing are not necessarily using ML, but the things that we are doing are things like education. So we run a summer school program, which has been hugely popular in the past. We get a bunch of grad students, undergrads. In the past, the program has been in Canada. And we also run an online course. So there's things related to education and outreach, just making people aware of the problems that exist at this intersection and essentially drawing more researchers and more eyes to the problems and solutions at hand. We also do a bunch of R&D support, I would say. So for example, we've got a data gaps project running right now, where the idea was that one of the things that stops us from developing effective machine learning solutions is the lack of data. And so it's important to identify what data is needed by which researchers so that in the future people can work on collecting that data. So right now we're just going through the range of problems related to climate change, mitigation, adaptation, science, and trying to figure out what data sets need to be created. We've also got a funding program, so we fund researchers. We've been very fortunate to have pretty substantial corpuses of money in the past to distribute. We're going to continue to do that in the future. And another thing that we do is community. So we've got a community online through our newsletter, through a Circle app, and most importantly, an academic community of folks who show up to our workshops, present papers, submit papers to the workshops that we co-host with machine learning conferences usually.
Oh, okay. So the way I understand it is that climate change AI is more of an enabler to, you know, pretty much welcome students and create awareness among people that, hey, you know, if you are an expert in machine learning, if you have the technical know-how, maybe this is an area that you should discover or try to solve the problems for.
Yeah, I wouldn't say just students, though. It's also been a lot of practitioners and industry folks. But yes, it's, we definitely see ourselves as the people who will catalyze research and maybe draw eyes to the issues that we think are important.
I think initially you mentioned that climate change AI does not do research, but I think you're not giving yourself enough credit. But because I feel like to come up with those numbers as to and identifying gaps also requires a significant amount of research. And I know research as a word can be used quite loosely in the sense that academic research is different from I researched on what products are out there in the market. So, but definitely.
No, thank you for bringing that up because you're absolutely right. When I think of research, I'm thinking of people publishing papers or people having academic projects. Climate change AI does engage in a lot of thought leadership or policy suggestions. I know folks within the organization have been contacted to get, have been contacted for their inputs on regulations, for example. We were up at COP28 last year. So that's the sort of research that we do end up doing, just trying to be thought leaders in this space.
Yeah. And I've been asking this question to a lot of people who are in the climate tech space. I recently interviewed Volt Post, the co-founders of Volt Post, rather, where, you know, they are basically converting lamp posts at curbside and, you know, changing them into level 2 charging and so on. So I asked them that, you know, sometimes technology catches up, but policies don't. And I think it's a big problem, especially in the climate tech space. You know, lots of money pouring in, lots of investment, but policies are not catching up. So for a non-profit organization like Climate Change AI, is there significant machinery that is going into maybe changing some of that aspect, like changing the policy or probably reaching out to people to create more awareness on changing policies?
Oh, absolutely. I believe machine learning tools are being used to reach out to people. I'm not sure that that's a force for the good, though. So, I mean, especially ever since we got ChatGPT and ever since we got such easy access to large language models, I do believe we've seen a wave of propaganda or content or whatever you may want to call it. I mean, all content is propaganda for one thing or the other, right? So we've seen a wave of content like that. And I think the scary thing for me personally is that that's potentially going to be used to spread propaganda, to lobby for or against regulations, which can be, it will be a really effective tool, right? So we haven't really used machine learning tools to engage in anything like that yet. I'm sure in the future it's going to be a tool for information or disinformation around these issues.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, when you were talking about lack of data, I think one thing that comes to my mind is, you know, I was trying to create like a carbon aware website for my podcast.
Okay.
And it was extremely difficult to get live data about, you know, what source my electricity in my area is coming from. I mean, there are a few APIs like electricity maps that have data regarding aggregated sources. But when I say aggregated sources, aggregated carbon intensity levels and so on. But yeah, data is really hard to get. And yeah, it's an area of concern. And I just wanted to ask you, like, what are some of the major areas that you see there is lack of data? Is it the geographic or climatic aspects, or is it, you know, are things like electricity, for instance, right?
I think there's no dearth of areas where there's a lack of data in one way or the other, but I think one sort of systemic thing that we've observed is that it's pretty tightly correlated to how privileged the people are who live in that area. So for example, electricity, I'm sort of a power systems person, so that's what I'll speak about. We do have system maps in the state of California. We have some sort of capacity calculation. If you go to PG&E's website, you can see if they allow you to install solar or not. And the way they're doing that is because they have a map of the system. They sort of know where everything's connected. And they are going to make an assessment based on your home and your potential generation or consumption profile. You won't find data of that sort in developing countries or in poorer countries. There are places where they built out a power grid but forgot to map it. Well, didn't forget to map it, but they prioritized the resources to build the grid. And then maybe there wasn't proper planning. And then they no longer have maps of their power system data to the point where their simulations are essentially, oh, let's go out in the field and test this out. And if it breaks, then we know that's what our map looks like. So there's numerous such examples of situations where you'll find data for a privileged population, but not for an underprivileged population. Hmm.
Wow. Okay. So when we talk about machine learning AI, it's usually the software aspect, right?
Yep.
But I want to touch on some of the hardware problems that companies or, you know, researchers are trying to solve, especially in the battery and material science aspect, because, you know, with EVs being or going to be mainstream in the future, I think these are some of the areas that also need some enhancement. What are some of the examples that come to your mind when you think about machine learning in so-called tough tech?
Machine learning and so-called tough tech. Yeah, I'm actually not sure.
Okay.
So I'm just super confident after my PhD of saying that I don't know about this because I don't know about it.
Yeah.
There's definitely a lot of research in this area. So approximating. So there's either the approach of using generative models to come up with new chemistries and new designs. There's also definitely the quick simulation angle where you use machine learning to speed through simulations that you don't have the time to do in real life. I'm not sure how many of these are actually being deployed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you told me that you are a PhD in electrical engineering and you are extremely passionate about this field, but you don't currently work in the area of climate tech. But looking out, you know, maybe 5 years or 10 years down the line, I think we will be closely zeroing in on the whole 2030 climate pledge and, you know, 10 years before Paris and so on. What is the one thing that you're super excited about to work or at least follow in the next 5 to 10 years?
One thing that I'm super excited, I hope someone solves it, is scalable nuclear fission. First solve nuclear fission and then make smaller reactors that we can distribute across the power system. And the reason I say that is because if it's safe and you actually have a reliable technology like that, you essentially solve the climate problem. At least you're going to stop all future emissions, right? Because if you enter into this new era of energy abundance, you don't need to think about energy efficiency. You don't need to think about optimizing energy consumption based on emissions. You just do away with all of these problems because you have surplus, you're energy abundant. That's probably a pipe dream though. So that's something that I hope someone solves. I'm not sure if it's going to be more realistically or pragmatically. I think one thing that I hope comes to be true in the future is green hydrogen. So true green hydrogen, not greenwashed and not color-coded to appear cute. Because we will have this problem of energy abundance, or at least the potential to have energy abundance in certain areas, in a solar belt, for example, and these really hard to electrify or hard to clean up sectors. So that's an area that I hope progresses and I get to engage in.
Yeah, I mean, the way you answered that question, I feel like more than solar or any other source of energy, you seem to be really bullish about nuclear fission.
Oh, I wouldn't say bullish.
Okay.
I would say
naively
hopeful.
Okay, would be a nice to have
kind
of. Okay. What are some of the challenges in pursuing that path as of today, nuclear fission, I mean?
I think a lot of development. So it's really difficult as an outsider to assess the state of the technology as it is right now. There's a bunch of startups in this space, but they're secretive, which they should be. And I don't know, it's really easy to be skeptical about a technology like that, right? So I have my doubts about how successful or how commercializable they're going to be.
Yeah, when I think about it, I feel like the high entry barrier is probably one of the points of concern when it comes to startups in the space, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, solar, you can do it. I mean, it's not going to have a huge amount of investment, but something like a nuclear fission is, I feel like multiple countries or even multiple companies need to come together,
yeah,
form some sort of a consortium and solve this. And it's going to be extremely difficult for a startup to do it. That's just my thought.
And that's going to be so difficult to do because there's very differing public opinions across the world on nuclear in general. Like Germany has completely phased it out. It's sort of difficult to imagine an EU consortium working on nuclear. So,
yeah,
I agree.
Or it'll happen something like what happened with Boeing and Airbus. US is going to start it and EU is going to follow with Airbus.
Yeah.
So, that's fantastic. You know, there's a lot of chat about ethics, and I think you also briefly touched upon in this age of ChatGPT, how ethically or you know, AI is going to be used in terms of spreading propaganda for or against climate change is going to be one of the concerns. But when it comes to using AI in climate change, do you think there is an ethics problem at all?
Oh, I think there's a potential to have huge ethics problems. The fundamental problem is that you're going to have this worldwide climate change phenomena that is going to affect populations that are disadvantaged. It's going to be folks in the low-lying coastal areas who are probably not, they're not like the US coastal elite, right? It's consumption in one country impacting residents in another country. And even for climate change adaptation, richer countries or richer folks will be able to deal with the fallout in a better way than those who are less equipped. So inherently, there's going to be these systemic inequalities caused by climate change. And then on top of that, you put in machine learning, the power of having, the power of using data to make decisions in some of these cases is enormous. So I already touched a little bit on how there's going to be unequal access to data. So you're going to have models which are biased. There's also the huge potential to have machine learning be applied to technologies or to solutions which might not necessarily be the best solution for climate change. So an example of that is, self-driving cars. That's no longer maybe the hot problem for machine learning, but 5 years back it was.
Yeah, I think people have realized that to solve self-driving cars, you need to solve human intelligence, which is tough.
there's still a huge amount of money being thrown at self-driving cars and at computer vision in general, right?
Yeah.
So one of the problems with that is if you do realize the vision that all of these companies have, which is self-driving cars are super safe, super reliable, they can travel anywhere, you get the costs down, you are basically incentivizing a system of transportation which is not the most efficient or not the most climate friendly. So you're locking us in to this road-based system of transportation. Everyone is going to have a self-driving car or some sort of self-driving app.
You know, the argument against that is that, if you own a car, like today, then it's sitting in the parking garage for, I don't know, 20 hours a day.
Yeah.
20 is still an overestimate. But once you have self-driving cars, it's going to be like Southwest Airlines, it's going to keep on.
Understood. Yeah, so I agree. So that's one potential, that you're going to get more use out of each car. And so potentially you're reducing that entire emissions impact of the manufacturing of the car or manufacturing so many cars in the first place. But the alternative is that you're not, you don't have self-driving buses. So instead of waiting at a bus stop to get on a bus, you have a self-driving car, which is amazing for convenience, but maybe not the best climate solution. And at that point, once you solve the self-driving car problem with machine learning, we're not even going to be thinking about the climate ramifications. That's the problem with so many of the solutions that we have right now, where it's really difficult to get the political will to think about the climate ramifications of a solution once it already exists, once it's already the cheapest and best solution. And so yeah, it's basically technology is going to evolve in a way that's good in some ways, without necessarily thinking about the climate impact, and machine learning is probably going to aid that.
Yeah, interesting thought, because you know, whenever we talk about solving climate change, applying AI, you know, there is this notion, or you know, people have this idea that it's going to be for greater societal good.
Yeah.
But if the AI and the technology rests in hands of, say, the West or people who are more powerful, things are going to be biased, and it's probably going to be not that great for underdeveloped, or like how people call them, the Global South these days. So yeah, before we end this podcast, I want to ask you about your volunteering work with Climate Change AI, and if someone wants to get associated with Climate Change AI, how can they be a part of it?
So I started volunteering with Climate Change AI because they were an academic. I used to think that they were a primarily academic organization. And so if folks want to join, we have an annual recruitment cycle. That's when you should apply. I think we just went through this year's phase. So sometime around end of this year is when we'll start our next phase. In general, though,
could you give me more details on, so annual recruitment cycle is that there are fixed positions, or how does it work?
We try to think of ourselves, so we try to make every volunteer be the CEO of their own role. So the idea is that you have a lot of ownership. There's some defined responsibilities. So if you're in the programs committee, you're likely going to be helping organize programs and not really working on the newsletter. But there's an incredible amount of flexibility as well. And I've always found that I can basically do whatever I want because someone's always in need of help. In general, though, I think the way to volunteer is, if you're American, there are huge political organizations that are lobbying for climate change. And it seems like that's the most effective climate action there is, which is voting in the right people and getting money moving in the right way. And I think the same holds true for India as well.
Okay, fantastic. So I hope many people visit the Climate Change AI website and you know, probably help volunteer and contribute. But thank you so much, Utkarsha.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it was great talking to you. Thank you.